Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. Today I welcome back Mike McNichol, the Clatsop County Public Health Director, to discuss new department programs, including one for cancer survivors and their families, as well as follow-up on some existing services, including a syringe exchange program for IV drug users. The Public Health Department offers a diverse range of services to the county's 37,000-plus residents, from family planning to immunizations to disaster preparedness. McNichol has some 23 years' experience in public health and has served as the department's director since 2016 and prior to that as its environmental health supervisor. Before joining the department, he directed the Yamhill County Health Department from 2007 to 2011. He holds a Master's of Public Health from the Oregon Health and Science University. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the studio, Mike.
Well, thank you.
Let's start by you telling me about the program for cancer survivors. What is that?
Yeah, the program is called the Step It Up program, and it was designed by the Knight Cancer Society folks. And so we found this grant possibility a few months ago, and we said, hey, well, why don't we try for this? And it was for $15,000. Mm-hmm. And the program is actually based on a model of getting cancer survivors and their families involved in more physical activity, because the data shows that cancer survivors who actually engage in daily or at least weekly activity, to the degree they're able, have much better prognosis, long-term prognosis. So we started that program with the assistance of the folks here at the OHSU Knight Cancer Facility right down the street. And we worked to get several teams going. Right now we have three groups who meet. They meet on Mondays and Wednesdays from 5:30 to 6:30 at the indoor college track at the school.
At Patriot Hall.
Community College, yep. And then on Thursdays there's another group that meets at Providence Seaside in the Laurel Clinic from 5:30 to 6:30. And anyone who is a cancer survivor or is a family member of a cancer survivor is more than welcome. And when you do join at no cost, we actually give you a goodie bag with a pedometer and some other things to help you continue that that program.
Well, that's wonderful. So what exactly does the grant provide?
So the grant provided us the startup funding with staff to actually get the groups going. It paid for one of my nursing staff to facilitate some group work, to reach out to the different groups to get these goodie bags together, to reach out to Columbia Clatsop Community College to get their track available for us, and to actually then get the groups together and show them how these work, and then find leaders of these groups to maintain the groups over long periods of time. And right now we have 10 to 12 participants who meet weekly, which is pretty good. We'd like to have a lot more, so we encourage anybody to come out and walk these courses.
So, yeah, what are the participants doing during a session?
So basically, you meet with your leader, like at the track, that's the indoor track up at Clatsop Community College. They meet and they talk about, you know, life a little bit, and then they just keep on the walk as far as long as they want to, for about an hour.
That's great.
They have a pedometer and they see what their mileage is. And actually, what one of the things we're trying to do is have a little small competition so you can generate the most miles period of time, and we would offer prizes or gift cards. So we try to make it fun and entertaining. And, you know, this, I think if we can make this work over the long term, that, you know, for cancer survivors, this is a great way to get out from underneath the burden that it is to have a cancer diagnosis and then survive it, and then come back into and have this exercise facilitated by a professional, and then being able to people who have had the similar situations they have. I think it's a great opportunity.
Now, you mentioned there are three groups. Are they all meeting in Astoria at Patriot Hall?
The two on Monday and Wednesdays are at Patriot Hall, but the one on Thursdays, or one on Tuesday, pardon, is at Providence Seaside at the hospital. So that's where that one is.
How would somebody get involved in the program?
So they can make a call to the health department and ask for Sarah Mitchell, and that number is 503-325-8500.
And Sarah is a nurse at the department?
She is.
And what if somebody is just getting out of treatment and they're not very strong yet, but they'd like to participate? Are there different levels or speeds of participants?
Yeah, absolutely. These groups are all geared toward the individuals. So as fast or as slow as you're able to go, you know, they are monitored by a group leader to make sure you feel comfortable. You know, if you're only able to walk a quarter of a mile, that's great. If you're able to walk 10 miles, even better. So there's no competition within those groups. It's what you're able to do comfortably without getting outside of what you're supposed to by your doctor's orders.
And somebody won't be completely left behind?
No. Okay. Absolutely not.
That's nice to know.
Yeah.
And you've got just about 10 participants among the three groups right now?
Yeah, we have about 10 to 12 among the three. We'd like to see a lot more if we can get them to come.
How long do you hope to keep the programs going?
Well, the grant's going to end at the end of October, but we'd like to keep the groups going on as long as possible, hopefully for the indefinite term. So we're actually going to look to see if the Knight Cancer folks are going to actually open up round two of this implementation and see if we can continue the program and have a little more funding to see if we can expand it.
Good. You mentioned that data supports exercise for cancer patients. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so the data does show that cancer survivors who are engaged in physical activity post-surgery, and are in remission, the data does show that they have a much more, the more exercise you get, the longer those you can, the benefits health-wise outweigh anything you might have, not just for your physical health, but your mental health. That's the other big portion of this, because, you know, cancer survivors, that's a big thing to go through, is having a cancer diagnosis, go through surgery, treatment, radiation, chemo, and then you're through and you're like, wow, what happened? So having the support group of folks who have the same experience, you get that group feeling about people who can share that with you, understand where you're coming from, and there's a lot of mental health as well as physical health advantages.
Oh, I would think so, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, let's shift gears quite a bit and talk about a proposal that the Board of Commissioners approved at their last meeting to build a new hazardous, or actually not a new, a hazardous waste disposal site.
Right. So so household hazardous waste is the name we're giving. It's going to be the Clatsop County Household Hazardous Waste Facility. It's a proposal that started about 10 years ago, right after the county Public Works Department got out of doing solid waste as part of their functions. The household hazardous waste piece was still a public health function because it's not part of the waste stream. It's the stuff that shouldn't be in the waste stream, your batteries, your pesticides, herbicides, motor oils, batteries, those kind of things. They need to get, they shouldn't be in the waste stream because those products have, once they're in the waste stream and they go to a landfill, they're going to leak and they're going to create a bigger environmental problem than they would if you can properly collect them, transport them, and treat them and get rid of them safely. So trying to get that material out of the waste stream is the goal of this thing. So after 10 years of work...
10 years?
10 years it took to get here. Actually, it really wasn't a lot of work until last year. It was one of those projects that was, in my opinion, needed to get done. Either we're going to do it or we're not. So we hired a consultant and a contractor, put together some bids, and we came up with a proposal that the commissioners could buy off on. And it's going to be a great facility. It's going to be located across the way from the new high school football stadium.
On Williamsport Road.
And right below where the transfer station is. So people will be able to drive up in their cars with their materials, their batteries, pesticides, herbicides, whatever. We'll have a whole list of things we'll take for free. And if you're a county resident, you get to drop those materials off at no cost to you.
Wow. Is there any limit on how much you can bring?
There is not.
So, and that is right in Astoria for those who aren't familiar with where the transfer station is. So you mentioned some examples of hazardous waste. What are some others that we don't usually think about?
Fluorescent tubes is one. Engine oils and lubricants, those are some. The batteries you use every day, the D and C and B and A cells, all of those should be put in the household hazardous waste and not thrown away. Things you use in your garden, like Roundup, that stuff should not go in a waste stream. If you're not using it, if it's old, it needs to be taken to a household hazardous waste facility. Some of the things could be if you have any kind of antifreeze, that's a good example. We'll recycle that. And eventually we'll probably take white goods, which are your refrigerators, those kind of things. So those are kind of the things that we'll be able to deal with, get them properly containerized and then stored and then taken to a proper facility for recycling and or disposal.
I'm not sure if this is hazardous waste, but what about old computers?
Those fall under a different, those are electronics. So
Okay.
we wouldn't be able to take that. What would happen with those usually is they actually end up in the waste stream, unfortunately. But, you know, Recology and some other of these solid waste facilities actually take those goods and then break them apart and take their materials out of the nickel and the cadmium, those kind of heavy metals that need to be removed from that and then get rid of it so they can be recycled.
Okay. How much is this all going to cost?
So right now we have a maximum guaranteed price of about $1.2 million to have the building built. And just to let your listeners know, the majority of the money is not for the facility. Because we're building this facility on what used to be an old landfill, which is reusing the old land, there's a lot of work that has to go on the ground before we can even build the building. We have to have a methane mitigation system to collect the methane that's being produced by the old landfill and collecting it and distributing it into the atmosphere without making a hazard or an explosion hazard within the building. We also have to drive pilings about 60 feet down through the garbage in order to get to the bedrock to actually have the building be stable and won't fall off the side. So that's where the expense is actually coming from. About two-thirds of the cost is in requirements for building on a landfill.
Where does the funding for the building or the construction come from?
That's a good question. We have several funding streams. The first one is that for every ton of garbage that's disposed of at the transfer station, is there's a surcharge, and we call it a surcharge on the tipping fee, is a $3.50 charge for every ton of garbage. So that amount of money Recology has been collecting and keeping in a fund just to fund this facility. So we have been keeping that for the last 4 or 5 years. So that's part of the fund. We also have something at the county called a special projects fund, which is county money that's we will be in reimbursing, but it's used for capital investment and projects. We can pay that back with the money, but we need the capital up front. We also have, we're going to be getting a loan from the Brownfield, from the Business Oregon Group, which will be, that money will be specifically for the DEQ requirements of methane mitigation and the pilings, because that's not really a building issue. That's the brownfield itself. That's what they call a used landfill, is a brownfield. That's what they're going to reuse it for. So that money will be for that. We also have $77,000 from a grant from the Department of Environmental Quality. And then of the money we borrow from the Brownfield Group, $60,000 of that will be in terms of a grant, and they're going to forgive us that amount from the loan. So in essence, of the $1.3 million or $1.2 million, you know, $130,000 of it is grant money. The rest of it is paid for by tipping fees. So there is no county general fund involved in this at all.
That sounds like a good plan.
Yes.
I'm sure taxpayers will appreciate that.
Exactly.
Will people outside of the county be able to use this facility?
They can, but outside of the county, we'll have to charge a fee because this is for in-county folks only. We'll also be able to do at least once a month. We're also going to have a commercial day where people from businesses who may have a lot more materials, the paints, the whatever they may have, we'll have a day a month that they can come and dispose of their stuff too. Now, we're going to charge them because they're small quantity generators, but they'll still be a lot cheaper than trying to drive to Portland or Hillsborough to get rid of the material.
When will the facility be open?
Well, if everything goes well, we're hoping to be open by the November-December timeframe.
Oh, excellent.
Assuming we run into no problems.
That's great. I'm a bit surprised that hazardous waste disposal falls under the purview of the county health department. Has it always been that way?
Not in Clatsop County. I guess sometime in the mid-1990s, Clatsop County Public Works Department actually had a solid waste department, but when they moved away from that model, somehow household hazardous waste became a public health concern. And because of the nature of the materials, it is a public health concern themselves.
Certainly.
So I can see the tie-in there, but, you know, we're really not an organization that specializes in solid waste, but luckily, I've done solid waste in the past in my background, solid waste permitting facilities and that kind of work, so that won't be too much of a stretch.
Well, that's good. Well, moving on to a program that is already existing, the syringe exchange program. Last time that I spoke with you, you gave me what sounded like an astronomical number for how many syringes you had collected so far. Tell me how that's going, the program in general.
It's going very well. It's actually, we've had about 150 participants now at this point. We've collected 65,000 needles at this point. We actually have three locations. We have the Providence Seaside Hospital location. We're also in Warrenton now at the Fred Meyer near the bus stop, and then still in the Astoria on 32nd Street down by Safeway. We do a plan to open a fourth location sometime in June at the health department itself for those folks who feel more comfortable coming to the health department. We'll do that on Fridays, but we'll make an announcement through our Facebook page and through our county website about that announcement so that folks who are more comfortable to do that, we can do that for them. So that's sort of where we're at. So,
if you're just joining me, you are listening to a pre-recorded interview with Clatsop County Public Health Director Mike McNichol. He is discussing some new department programs and following up on some existing programs, including a syringe exchange program for IV drug users. This is Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio. Do you think you've reached the peak of needle collection yet? Or are you still, is it still growing?
I think we've hit the peak of the iceberg, unfortunately.
Really?
So every week, the numbers continue to increase from week to week of the number of needles we, from week to week, from the very beginning, you know, the highest number was 3,000, and we were shocked by that. But last week, we just collected almost 6,000. So it's a number that just every week is going up. So I don't think we've really even touched the surface, really, of where we're going to see this go.
Are there just a few people bringing the needles in?
It used to be that way, but now we have, I think, trust has been built with that group of that population. So we're seeing a lot more people actually participate as individuals and fewer messengers. So we're seeing quantities grow up because they're bringing in their materials as well. So I think it's just a matter of time before we see the, you know, start digging deeper to where this really is going to end.
Now, this is also a grant-funded program. When does the funding run out?
So we actually got a donation from the Friends of Columbia County, the old board that used to be in charge of the Coastal Family Services. They gave us $50,000 as seed money to get started. Since then, we actually was awarded a grant from Columbia Pacific CCO for $17,500, where we bought a new van so that we can drive around and do these things. We also recently was awarded $60,000 in a grant from Multnomah County, working with them on their program, so we'll be able to work a similar kind of, so we have kind of a regional approach. And then we also have, we received another grant from the state through the prescription drug overdose program to pay for the staffing of that program as well. So we have several different streams of funding for that. But, you know, at some point, probably around the year, in the budget year 1920 or fiscal year 2019-2020, I'll ask for some more money from the general fund to help pay for this.
But you've got the program extended at least until that point?
At least, yeah.
And how is the reception from the general public?
General public, the folks we see, they're very thankful. And a lot of their friends and families have actually said they're thankful too. So, you know, we have, you know, some people do drive by and shake their heads, and that's, you know, that's to be expected. But the majority of people, we've actually had people stop, get out of their cars who are recovery, folks who are in recovery, and say, you know, thank you for this. We didn't have this back when I was an addict, and this has made a big difference in a lot of people's lives. I wish we had that when they were having issues. So I think that's what's going to be helpful, is that, you know, that those folks have, because of all the shame that goes along with the IV drug, you know, we're trying to give them compassion and make them feel like there is somebody there who cares, and that when they are ready to go into recovery, we're going to help them get there.
Have you had anyone go into recovery as a result of your recommendation and working with them?
We've had 3 people, actually, out of that group. So that's, you know, my goal when we first started was 1. And so we've already tripled that. So, you know, anybody we can help get into recovery is a victory for us. So now whether or not they maintain in recovery, you know, that's really not something I can say. But if we can just get them that first step and that harm reduction piece, that's our goal. So.
And what do you say to someone who would argue that you're just enabling an illegal habit?
So what I say is this, is that, you know, our job in public health is not to look at the addiction itself. Our job is harm reduction. So we see harm reduction as if someone is continuously using a used and dirty needle, the cost of that person injecting themselves with HIV or hepatitis C or any number of other things is far greater to all of us than it is for us to give them a clean needle. So we see it as we're preventing that person who may have an addiction from getting a communicable disease that then can be spread around our community. That's my response.
Do you see fewer needles being just dropped on the ground?
Anecdotally, I think we can show that that's actually true. One of the things we do pass out as part of this program is we do give out proper sharps containers, or the little red containers you put needles in. We've passed out almost 350 of those, and almost all of them have come back. So we're seeing that we're changing the practices where they're not being thrown out indiscriminately. There is a practice now of knowing where they can dispose of them properly, and we get them back and then send them on their way for proper disposal.
You've mentioned in the past that you also give out naloxone kits.
We do. So our partner, Carrie Strickland with Jordan's Hope for Recovery, she goes out every Thursday with us at the 3 locations, and she has she has naloxone training, the naloxone training plus the kits. And these are the better kits that actually have a voice activated system. So if you have someone who's in an overdose situation and you take the cover off, this thing actually walks you through verbally about how to do it, how to save somebody's life. And we've passed out of the 200 kits she's had for our program, we're only down to 32 left. So we're actually made quite a bit of progress. And we know for a fact that they've been being used. So we actually are saving lives.
And you also mentioned before we went on the air that you're hoping to get some detox beds in the county. Can you say more about that?
So as people might know, that in the treatment and addiction thing, one of the pieces that's missing in our county is if someone, an IV drug user, comes to us, exchanges needles, but then says, you know, I'm really done with this lifestyle. I need recovery. I want out. We don't have a place to put them to detox. You know, we'd have to take them to Columbia County or to one of the private places. What we really need is a community bed where we can take them and say, detox, and then we'll get you into recovery and treatment services. So we had a conversation this morning with Alan Evans and Raven Brown from Helping Hands, and we've agreed to partner on having a community beds at the new Uniontown facility that they're working on. And what we would have is the ability to be able to refer our clients that we see during the syringe exchange to one of four beds, two female and two male beds, where someone can actually get that detox here locally without having to go anywhere away from their family, away from their support system, and see if we can get them into the new system of detox, treatment, recovery, and then reintroduction back into their lives, back into the community. So that's where we're going to go with that.
And how would that be funded?
Well, right now, the way it would be funded is we're going to look for capital investments. We need about $125,000 to get the Uniontown facility prepared for this kind of a situation. And then the ongoing costs would be fairly limited because we really have public health would donate our materials and supplies. And we'd have nurses who would be there to actually do the non-medical detoxing, observation, and care. And then they, in exchange, Helping Hands would have the facility, and they would have some social workers and the sheltering that would occur there. So the partnership would be that we would actually have a continuum from IV drug users to harm reduction to detox to treatment and then to recovery, all in our county. So that's our goal. So I'm going to be working with all of our local partners and searching high and low for some grant money.
When do you hope to get that going?
I don't know when for sure. Whenever Uniontown is ready to start, I know they're going to set the scaffolding up next week to actually start the process.
Really?
That's what I was told today. So we're going to hopefully in the next few months we can get this thing going. So once they have the structural stuff fixed, then we can move in and get the internal structures so that we can have this this bed set up.
And for those who aren't aware, that's the big yellow. It looks like an old boarding house building in Uniontown, Astoria, right near the Astoria Bridge. So that is going to be open, I've heard, sometime this summer? Or is that, am I thinking that's when work starts?
That's when work starts. Work starts next week. That's what I've heard.
Okay. Well, that's excellent. So the county has no detox beds right now?
No.
So where do those people go?
Well, right now we work with the folks in Columbia County, and we try to refer them through that program. And some of the private folks will also have some beds, but if you're on Oregon Health Plan, there really isn't a place to go. And what we're trying to do is bridge that between if you are an IV drug user and you don't know if you have health insurance, but you may qualify for OHP, we're actually going to have Oregon Health Plan, what they call as sisters, come with us to actually make sure they're eligible and we can get them on the health plan, and then we can start dealing with those resources. And Oregon Health Plan will actually pay for the detox piece. So that's how this will be. It'll be a billable thing. And these people, most of those folks are probably eligible for that program. And actually what we're finding is that, ironically, is that most people who actually come to syringe exchange are already insured and they're not homeless. So we have quite a number. Yeah. It's not a homeless population that we're seeing. It's the functionally addicted that are coming in their cars, in their nice clothes, coming by switching out needles and leaving. So it's quite a bit different population than most people would think.
Well, I made an assumption there that wasn't correct. So would we be surprised if we knew who these people were?
Very.
Wow. So they're all across our community.
Anywhere between the teens to up to 82 years old.
Wow. All socioeconomic classes?
All socioeconomic classes. Yep.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
And it really is affecting the 31 to 40-year-olds. So it's not the real young and it's not the real old. And the majority of those folks are not technically homeless. A lot of them are still, they have their own home or they live with somebody or they have a partner, but they're addicted. So
why do you think that age group?
I think it's because of the opioid epidemic is from the tail end of the heroin epidemic is on the tail end of the opioid epidemic. And a lot of these folks were on opioids for long periods of time due to a work injury or a home injury or dental appointment or what have you. They were given copious amounts of, you know, OxyContin or some derivative thereof. And, you know, they didn't need that, but they became addicted. And once the prescription ran out, then they had to, you know, the craving for heroin and that opioid craving is, from what I understand, is almost overwhelming. So you'll do anything to try to get that craving satisfied. So folks will go out and then start using heroin as a replacement because heroin is an opioid, as is OxyContin.
So that's what's driving the addiction problem.
It is right now, yeah.
Wow.
You know, and people think, well, if you do a syringe exchange, you're encouraging people to have use drugs. And I would encourage them to say, do you know anybody who wants to inject themselves with anything?
True. Yeah. Good point.
So, you know, and I would argue that if you ask any of these folks, and we have, not a one of them want to be addicted.
What do you see as the solution to getting a handle on the opioid problem? I think I've asked you that before, but I'll ask again.
So, you know, that's a great question. So I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg here. I don't think we have a real handle on what it really looks like, especially if you look at the functionally addicted. And once opioids and OxyContin and those derivatives are actually cut out of somebody's prescription habits, I think we're going to see a lot more heroin before this is over. And unfortunately, in my opinion, as a public health person, I think we're going to lose a whole lot of people. With synthetic fentanyl coming, what they're experiencing on the East Coast, that's going to kill a lot of people before we see the end of this.
And is that an opioid?
It is. It's manufactured in China, and it comes here. And they're actually printing it on pills that look like any other pill. So you don't know what you're getting. So and that's what killed Prince, the musician. He thought he was on one thing and was on synthetic fentanyl, and it killed him. So that's what we're going to be seeing a lot more as the wave of synthetic fentanyl comes our way.
If people wanted more information about the program, the syringe exchange program, or help, what could they do?
They could start by calling us, 503-325-8500. Or I would highly recommend going to Jordan's Hope for Recovery website. They have an entire page dedicated to all the resources you would need if you're an addict or if you need help or recovery. It's a fantastic resource. And Carrie Strickland, you could call her. Her number's on there. She'd be more than happy to help you.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Mike. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank my guest, Mike McNichol, the Clatsop County Public Health Director, for coming into the studio to discuss some new department programs, as well as follow up on some existing services. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Clatsop County Public Health offers a diverse range of services to the community, from family planning to immunizations to disaster preparedness. McNichol has served as the department's director since 2016 and prior to that as its environmental health supervisor. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. The show is brought to you in part by a grant from the Clatsop County Cultural Coalition. Perspectives was engineered today by Brian Bovenizer. The show can be heard Fridays on the stations of Coast Community Radio. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you would like to contact me, send me an email to perspectives@coastradio.org. Thanks for listening.